Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Ilana Redstone, who is an Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She is also co-director of the MIM Institute at UATS. She is the creator of the Beyond Bigots and Snowflakes video series and the author of The Certainty Trap, coming out in summer 2024. Welcome, Ilana.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. So you have a book coming out in a few months, The Certainty Trap. And the byline underneath that is, it says, why we need to question and clarify our thinking to reduce political polarization, increase social trust, and change how we see the world. If only it was that easy.
I never said it was easy. Yeah.
And so do you want to sort of summarize the sort of the main points of the book?
Yeah, I mean, so really what this is an attempt to, so the way I see the problem of certainty is a problem of how we view people who disagree. So when we feel, we could talk about sort of the philosophical implications of certainty and what that means, but more narrowly, if you think about the one foundational premise for democracy is really that we view each other as capable, fundamentally capable of however you want to say it, reasonable thought or, right? Like, and so if you, that is the idea of a democracy. Like, so if you don't think that that's true, then there are other, you could have a monarchy or a dictatorship or whatever. And right. But the idea of democracy is that we view each other as fundamentally capable of reasonable thought. That doesn't mean that there aren't exceptions to that. But it means sort of by and large, that's how we see each other. If we don't see each other that way anymore, which is kind of where we've ended up in a lot of our political discourse, if we don't see each other that way anymore, then what you want is not democracy, right? Like, I mean, the argument, if you really think that the other half in a two-party system, if you really think that the other half is hateful or stupid or just a bunch of sheep or whatever, right? Then why would you want to be in a democracy with these people? And so what I'm saying is actually, I think that is the fact that we're sort of, that many of us are kind of there is a result of this thing that I'm calling the certainty trap. So when we feel morally outraged, when we feel righteous indignation, those come from certainty, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the emotions and the sort of the intellectual places that lead to contempt for people who disagree. And that comes from, I mean, certainty is the thing that gives you permission to be morally outraged, right? Like, I mean, it's very hard to be outraged. It's hard to be morally outraged if you're not certain. And so the idea of the certainty trap is that there's sort of two solutions to this, both of which have implications for democracy. And in addition to viewpoint diversity, free speech, self-censorship, civil discourse, all of that, this is what I'm trying to solve, is really what I see as a problem in how we think, and all of the rest of it sort of flows out from there. And so if you, so the certainty trap, there's sort of, it's this idea that certainty fuels the moral outrage and righteous indignation that leads to contempt, that leads to sort of all of these political problems. And there are two solutions to it, really. One is understanding, just sort of fundamentally understanding uncertainty in the world, right? So whether that is uncertainty about the relationship between gender and biology, whether that's uncertainty about the causes of or solutions to inequality, uncertainty about the best immigration policy, right, which is contingent on even defining what best means. So that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is certain. The other thing that certainty does is it makes us really sloppy in our thinking. And so, right, so when we think, when we're certain about something, we don't see why we should make our assumptions explicit, our values explicit, our principles stated out loud. And so what that means in practice is it's a sort of an intellectual and moral commitment to not, for example, hang an argument on an assumption about your opponent's intent, ever, and which is very hard for people. But what it looks, so I'll just give you an example. So let's say that I'm having a conversation with someone who doesn't think that women should be allowed to drive. And maybe I'm not super excited about that. And so one way that I could disagree with this person is I could say, well, you're obviously a raging misogynist. Right. Like, so this would be one response that I could have. Now, where is that conversation going?
Yeah, it's a tough thing. So let me sort of back that a little bit. So you seem to align democracy with rationality. I grew up in South India, which is, some people say, it's the largest democracy in the world. And it's a country that, you know, voted for last names, religious prophets. So any sort of rational person would say this is not really democracy in the way that we define it, right? So democracy is orthogonal to this idea of having rational thoughts, I would say. Well, I shouldn't say orthogonal. It's sort of a different thing. I mean, people just assign labels to countries. We know Russia and North Korea, and, you know, those people are not democratic. And there we have two other countries who appear to be democratic, but we don't really have a lot of data on that, including the U.S., by the way. I'm not exactly sure if the U.S. is a democracy. What are your thoughts on that?
Hold on. I guess I want to close the loop on the example. The loop on the example that I started. So with the women, so like I asked the question, I said, well, I could say to this person, you're a raging misogynist. The other, that would be, the argument would be that that's sort of a certainty trap based. You're making it, again, I've hung my argument on my assumption about the person's intent. The other possibility in terms of my response might be something like, I think women should have equal rights under the law. Or something like, I think that everyone should be able to pursue their economic potential, and I think that driving is an integral part of that. As long as part of avoiding the certainty trap means understanding that there are no ideas that get a free pass. Everything can be criticized. There are no ideas that get sort of put up on a shelf where they can't be questioned or challenged or examined. So as long, in the driving example, as long as I'm willing to have someone come back to me and say, oh, that's interesting. You think women should have equal rights under the law? Like, are there limits to that? Do you think they should be drafted? Like, my intellectual and moral commitment is to being willing to engage or to at least think about that question, even if I don't have an answer to it. And there's nothing about there's nothing about avoiding the certainty trap that says, I have to let my principle go, right? Like, there's nothing that says I have to let it go. I have to change my mind. I have to suddenly think that women shouldn't be allowed to drive, right? I can still stand exactly where I was before, but now, but that conversation can continue in a way that it can't if I simply say, you're a raging misogynist, right? So it's a different way. So again, those are two different responses that I would point, that I would put, two different ways to kind of engage with disagreement. And so that's why the certainty trap is not saying, a lot of times what people will say is, you know, well, can you then not say what's right and what's wrong? Or can you not say this is good and this is bad? That's not actually what I'm saying at all. I'm saying you can say all of those things. You can declare, you can make all kinds of declarations about what's good and what's bad and what's right and what's wrong, as long as you're clear about what that means. Like, what does it mean? What is it? What are you trying to optimize for? What is the goal? What are you? I don't know how to understand good and bad until or unless we've been clear about what that means. It's almost like if I'm looking at a painting and I can say that painting is beautiful or that painting is ugly, I'm basing that on some, I don't know, I'm basing it on whatever the color, the composition, or the, you know, whatever it is about the painting, versus that painting is a bowl of fruit. Right, like one attaches value to it, the other one. So it's a little bit like that, you know, with what you're saying. So a couple of thoughts about, so I don't know, I would say democracy is orthogonal to certainty, or certainty is orthogonal to democracy. I do actually think those two are incompatible. So I would also, the other thing that I would say kind of in response to what you're talking about, and I'm certainly not an expert on the politics of India, I know about that much. But what I would say is that all of what I'm saying, and the Certainty Trap book largely, this work is really about, it's really going to resonate with people who either care about reducing political polarization, care about preserving democracy, it just gave me a thumbs up thing, care about preserving democracy, or care about understanding as best they can what's true about the world. If you care about something else more than you care about any of those things, so for example, if you care about, if the thing that you care about is winning an election, or if the thing that you care about is controlling a narrative with a fire hose of lies, and by lies, I mean something very specific. By lies, I mean something that you yourself don't believe to be true. Right. So then none of this stuff matters, because you are operating under a totally different incentive structure. So, and that assumption about, you know, if what people care about is either reducing political polarization, kind of preserving democracy, or understanding what's true about the world, I think that works for a lot of people. I think it works for probably the majority of people, but it doesn't work for everybody. Like, there's definitely, right? It doesn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So there is an issue here in terms of access to information.
Yeah.
So if I grew up in South Side of Chicago and I don't have a computer, I'll be a person. And if I grew up in North Side of Chicago and I had two computers, I'll be a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can really say how people are going to behave, right? So the initial conditions matter a lot. I mean, we have seen this in every domain, every problem that we are trying to solve. Initial conditions matter a lot. And so if you come with some initial conditions into trying to solve this problem, or having a debate, or having, you know, arguing about something, you are a person. The South Side of Chicago person is different from North Side of Chicago person. I can tell you this because I grew up, you know, but I went to both of those places. So there is an issue here in terms of initial conditions that we have to really think about, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't think there's anything that I'm saying that's inconsistent with that. One of the things that I would say, it does remind me of something. So in the book, I talk about, so one of the pieces of this, there's sort of three fallacies that I talk about in the book with respect to the certainty trap. One of them is the sort of meat of it is the settled question fallacy, which is treating the answer to some question is given and definitive, Or it could be treating the solutions as obvious and known, or saying that, you know, this thing has only advantages and no disadvantages, or only benefits and no costs, right? That could all be part of the settled question fallacy. And the idea is that, and I'm coming back around to what you were saying about the starting conditions, the second fallacy, like sort of once you've fallen to the settled question fallacy, is this fallacy of known intent. So this is what I was saying. These are the assumptions we make about other people's intent. And yeah, leaves that behind is really hard for me, for a lot of people. So let's say, and then the last one is actually, I actually flipped the order of these. The second one is the fallacy of equal knowledge. And so let me flip those. The subtle question fallacy, the fallacy of equal knowledge. So the fallacy of equal knowledge actually is the one that ties, I think, closer to what you're saying. This is the idea that if we all had the same information, we would all agree, right? So if we all knew the same thing about abortion, about gun control, about whatever, about policing, about gender, about whatever, that we would then all agree on. And so what this leads to is an assumption that what the gap between you and me, if we disagree on what on immigration is information. And that I'm going to give you information. I'm going to tell you what I know, and then you're going to agree with me. And this is why the fallacy of intent, known intent, comes third, right? Then when I do that, I tell you all of I drop all my wisdom on you, and then you still don't agree, then I make assumptions about your intent, right? Mm. Well, he knows all the things that I know, and he still doesn't agree with me. He still thinks that we should have open borders or build a wall or whatever. And what I'm saying is these are mistakes that we make in terms of in how we think about people who disagree and how we think about each other, how we think about each other's motives, and how we think about the world.
Yeah. Yeah, but as you say in the book, Ilana, information is uncertain. So it's not like we can create a capsule that you take and your cholesterol goes down predictably. Information is uncertain.
Yeah.
And so two people engaging on some sort of conversation, argument, debate, we don't debate anymore, unfortunately. Right. Debate used to be a very interesting thing, actually, when I was growing up.
Yeah.
You take the opposing party's views and you show why that view might be wrong, the data and analytics. We don't debate anymore. We just shout at each other, which is not quite debate. So where are we in terms of, I mean, information has a lot of uncertainty, as you say in the book. Yep. And so we cannot really, really sort of prescribe information to somebody else, right?
I mean, by prescribe information, are you talking about education? Is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, let's say, you know, you and I are having an argument about something. Unfortunately, I don't have too many arguments with my guests. I'm sort of biased toward their views. Suppose you and I have some argument of something, and then I say, you know, here is the information that you should look at. And I show you a couple of papers, and then I say, hey, these papers say you are wrong, but it's only two papers, but there is like 50,000 other papers out there that might say completely different. And so there's a selective process there. I mean, I can try to prove my argument by going into Google or NIH website or whatever, I'm thinking of life sciences here, and say, hey, look at these two, three papers. It says you're wrong, but there are 30 other papers that says you're right, actually, but I'm not going to show those.
I mean, I teach social science research methods and I teach statistics. And so, and, you know, and mostly what I tell students is if they remember nothing else from a 15-week semester, what I'd like them to walk away with is an understanding that our knowledge is probabilistic, that statistics is about probabilities and that it's not definitive and that there's always another possible explanation. So I guess a couple of things about information being uncertain. So a couple of things, and just with respect to what you said. One is there's nothing about, so in my language of avoiding the certainty trap, there's nothing about that that says that all explanations are suddenly equally likely to be right, right? Like, so, and so basically what it is, and one of the things I talk about in the book is, imagine if you have a number line, right, from 0 to 1, where 0 and 1 occupy positions of certainty. What I'm saying, and it's not a perfect example, but like what I'm saying basically is, there's nothing in the 0 or 1 place in the actual physical world that we live in. And, you know, people much smarter than I have, Einstein has made this point. Like, there are quantum physicists who have made this point. Like, right. Like, and so you're chopping off the endpoints. Now, of course, when you chop off the endpoints, you just create new endpoints. But we're going to forget that for a second. We'll just forget that for a second. So, and if you, but that's the space of confidence, right? Now you're in the space of confidence, and there's nothing that says that, for example, is the Earth flat or is it spheroid? Is suddenly a flip of a coin, right? Like, because you're talking about, now you could say, what is it that moves us along that line, closer to 1, closer to 0, right? Like, that, as far as I'm concerned, should be a conversation. Like, so is it, so for example, like, should it be what we think of as data and evidence? That's probably where I would land, but right, like, but that's not my starting point, right? I would have a conversation with some, if someone wanted to make the argument, for example, that we should, that someone's lived experience or anecdotal experience moves us closer to 1, I would be willing to have that conversation, right? Like, that's part of my commitment. But it's understanding that transition from 1 to 0.99 is categorically different than from 0.99 to 0.98. And yeah. And actually, then that difference matters. The other thing I would say is, you know, and I want to come back to your, why do you pick different studies? The other thing I would say is, there's a lot of what I'm saying that's very similar to, it's similar in a lot of ways to arguments for, well, why can't we just all be more curious? Or why can't we all just be more intellectually humble? Why can't we have more intellectual humility, et cetera? The problem with that, and I think those are all great and important, the problem with it is that most of us, when it comes to recognizing when we lack, for example, intellectual humility, most of us aren't very good at it. By the time you realize, oh, this is something I really should have some intellectual humility about, or this is something I should really, you know, question or whatever, like, you're sort of halfway there. And so what I'm saying is, the thing that you need to pay attention to is actually that feeling of moral outrage, righteous indignation, that feeling that the answers are easy, that the other person is an idiot or stupid or whatever, or hateful, right? That's the thing that you need to pay attention to either question or clarify, or both, your own thinking. And then the last thing I would say about, like, why, you know, pick these two studies, and I think that's right. I think, like, so let's say, you know, so say it's about COVID or it's about climate change or whatever, like, you could, or about, frankly, about, you know, gender and biology. It's all false. Like, you could find studies supporting all kinds of different claims and all kinds of different views. And you're right, it's not an even distribution. Most of the time, it's not 50% this and 50% that, and boy, it's just a toss up. But it's also not definitive, right? Like, so it's part of it is understanding that, yeah, I mean, my knowledge, and so then my knowledge isn't definitive, this claim isn't definitive. And then you're faced with the question of, well, given multiple possible explanations, why do I choose to believe one thing or another? Right. And I'll give you an example. Like, I was talking with a friend one time about, we were actually talking about sex trafficking for some reason. And she was saying, she was a little bit of a conspiracy theorist. And she was saying that, you know, she was like, well, I think that, you know, there are elected politicians are benefiting financially from sex trafficking, and this is why no one seems to be really cracking down on this as a problem. And I was like, she was saying this, and I was like, I guess, like, it's possible. Like, I couldn't sit here and tell you that it's not possible. Of course it's possible. And at the same time, like, here's another possibility, which is something like, you know, there really aren't any elected officials that are benefiting financially from sex trafficking. And for reasons that probably are not particularly well understood, that particular topic has not risen to the level, like maybe there aren't lobbyists that are, you know, that have enough power or whatever, for whatever reason, that hasn't risen to the level of the, to the top of the heap of social problems. And that's a very different explanation for, right, like for why there isn't more action against, just to use this example, sex trafficking. And so my question is to her was, why would I believe this, or why would I believe hers instead of mine? And the answer really comes down to trust. The answer really comes down to things like trust in institutions, right? Public trust, and all of which is eroded by certainty. So but it is like, my answer to her isn't, you're insane, that's impossible, because it's not, frankly, it's not impossible. It's not what I believe. And saying it's not impossible is not the same thing as saying, yeah, it's a 50-50 chance. Maybe she's right. Maybe I'm right. That's not what I'm saying. Acknowledging that it's not impossible is exactly that. It's just an acknowledgement that the probability isn't zero. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, so I'm thinking, Elena, that for solutions, we have 8 billion biologists say clones roaming around the earth. A lot of people don't accept that. They say skin color, you know, color of your hair, eyes, and everything is differentiating you. But we know from a DNA perspective, it's really cloning 8 billion people. And so the question, you know, I keep thinking about as clearly the initial conditions matter for all these 8 billion people. So their thoughts, their ideas, their expectations today all depend on where they started and how it got reinforced positively or negatively over time. And so, you know, I'm thinking, is there a solution to what you are sort of articulating here, which is, yeah, I mean, people have opinions. I mean, I have so many opinions, I can't even begin to think about them. So are there solutions? I mean, can we pass a regulation, for instance, that says, so suppose I say X is not a democracy statement, hypothesis. I have to show data. I have to hypothesis test that statement and prove that statement is correct before I articulate it. So can we actually regulate sort of hypothesis testing before you say something? I mean, it'll be not that interesting a world, I would say, some days.
I want to just make sure I'm understanding the question that you're asking. Your question at the end were, there was sort of, can we regulate hypothesis testing? Is that the question?
No, can we regulate opinions? So suppose I go out and say, this guy is bad. X is bad. Okay, so that's my statement. Immediately, I have to show some data why I believe that's the case. I have to show an abundance of data that hypothesis is actually true, just like, you know, any other scientific process. So can we actually take a general public to a process by which you say, when you make a statement, it has to have some substantial data and testing underneath that?
Are you saying, so if I say that this, so to use your example, this guy is bad, are you saying that I do have to back that up? Or that I should have to back that up? Which one?
If this regulation happens, you have to back it up, yeah.
Oh, I see. You're hypothetical. I mean, you're talking about sort of defamation in some ways. So a couple of thoughts. Like, so one is that what I'm... Okay, so a lot of the work that I'm doing and the book is, I almost divide... And it's not a bright line, but I think there's a little bit of a blurry line between the world of, and I want to come back to your question, like between the world of policy and the world of sort of how we talk about right? And the how we talk about policy, how we talk to each other. I'm very much in this space. In my view, like, there is a lot to say and do in the policy space. It's a little bit separate in the sense that what I care about is sort of, there are all kinds of policies that we can make, better policies, worse policies, depending on what you're trying to optimize for, like, and there's never going to be a policy where everybody gets what they want, right? And so the space that I'm in is really, given that there's always going to be disagreement and that we are aspirationally a democracy, how do we navigate the space in our communities, in our schools, in our families, in our faith communities, in our workplaces? How do we navigate all of these issues, these contentious issues? And there's nothing about kind of avoiding the problem of the certainty trap that says that you can't lobby for what you believe in, that you can't protest, that you can't take a stand on things. It's fully compatible with all of that. What I'm saying is it's about how you view the person who disagrees. So the goal is not agreement. Now, it is true that I do think that probably, it is true that better, however you define better, solutions will come out of a conversation between people who are not stuck in the certainty trap, but the solution isn't the goal. The being able to live with the disagreement is the goal. So when you say, like, as you're talking about, you know, could you have a policy where you had to back it up with that, like, you had, this was, you know, written into law or signed into law. I don't know. My first question is, I'm like, well, I can't imagine trying to regulate opinions, and no one would ever agree on what counts as evidence. Like, it's not like, so my first reaction is just like, well, how would that work? Like, no one would even agree. How would you even decide, like, what counts as evidence? Like, all of that should be subject to questioning and being challenged. And so, I mean, I know you're just running a thought experiment, but that's
I'm clearly running a thought exercise.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are two things here. One is the policy question, which is, is there a policy that will make the world better? It's very unlikely, as you say, because it seems like, you know, you have to prescriptively put down a lot of things. And, you know, anytime you do something prescriptive, it's not going to be a very good policy to start with. But what you're talking about is there some sort of social structure, which is, when I say X is bad, can I just leave it at that? Or should I? I mean, this is more of a social norm rather than a policy question. Should I say something more about it?
I don't know how to answer the should I question as separate from the goal, right? Like, so what is the goal? Is the goal to preserve democracy? Is the goal to reduce political polarization? Is the goal to sort of play your part in that? Then if that's the goal, then the answer is yes. Like, and one of the things that I'll tell students and groups is you don't have to care about any of this. Like, if you want to ignore everything that I'm saying, like, Godspeed, go forth. But don't then tell me that the thing that you're concerned about is political polarization or political discourse or democracy, like, threats, right? Like, don't, because you can't have it both ways. One of the things that I would say, like, with respect to policy and where these things get lost, one of the interesting examples is, I think one of the best, to me, one of the clearest examples of this is, you know, examples like policies and legislative attempts that control what's taught. Like, so for example, in higher education or in schools, like this has been done in Florida, right, with respect to race and gender and identity and all of these things. So those legislative attempts to control what's the way these topics are talked about, and this is, relates to book bannings and all these other things, the way it's an attempt to control, I mean, at some level to control the way people think, really, right? Is a solution that's rooted in certainty. right? It's a solution. It's a solution. And it's trying to solve a problem of certainty, right? Yeah. Like the problem with CRT or when, and you know, whatever, like the things in critical race theory is, the way I use that term, I use it very broadly to talk about a set of ideas, including colorblind racism and systemic racism, right? Like, that's what I mean. I don't mean like people are actually reading, you know, Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw. So I'm using it to describe a broad set of ideas. And so like that is a way of understanding the world that is rooted in certainty. The solution to that is recognizing that problem. The solution to it is not a solution that comes from certainty, right? Like there is in my view, there is a real problem there. I see it all the time. There is a real problem. That legislation is not it's not responding to an imaginary problem. It is a real problem. The response to a problem of certainty can't be certainty. Like you're doing this. And in terms of like solutions, yeah, it can be just restructuring, rethinking education, rethinking. I mean, it sounds easy. Oh, just rethink education. Right. But it's actually, I mean, like at the Mill Institute, we work with educators. I mean, in my own work, I work with students and other, right. Like, and it's not impossible to do. People, part of it is just understanding that this is what's going on. And that if you can, I mean, and actually one of the things that's come up is that since the conflict between the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, since October 7th, lots of people have pointed out, in higher education and also in K-12 schools, largely in high school, they have found themselves totally unprepared to navigate this. I mean, you watch it on any, you know, look at Harvard or Penn or whatever, like they have found themselves completely unable to navigate space. Partly because they've been doing this whole thing, like this failure to avoid the certainty trap on it's an own goal, right? It's just like a total own goal. So now one of the things that I see is just places that are like, oh wow, we really need to do. In fact, I was in a call with a school today and they were saying, yeah, this is the thing, this October 7th attacks and the war that followed, like this is the thing that kind of, this is the kick in the pants, but we really should have been doing this all along. Like, and by doing this, I mean, creating a space where people can disagree, where people are clear about their assumptions and their principles and their values in a way that doesn't make assumptions about intent, that doesn't condemn, that creates that space. And I think we have not done a good job of doing that.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Socrates in your book, Einstein. I don't know if you mentioned Einstein. I think you do.
I mentioned it here. I mentioned in the book,
And then we have Dalai Lama, more contemporary. They are pretty wise people who have figured this thing out, basically saying, hey, once you figured everything out, that you can only go down from there. So we have had this information for a long time by, you know, really beautiful people. But we haven't been able to communicate that to the larger population, right? I mean, education hasn't done it, I would argue. Education is, I'm not exactly sure what education is doing currently. So what do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have absolutely sort of fallen asleep at the wheel here. My hope is that this way that I'm framing it and understanding the problem is useful to people. So for example, like one of the things that you can do is you can say, all right, is there, and I do this, I'm teaching the Bigots and Snowflakes class right now. You know, you can say for any argument, is there a version of this argument that I could understand, like that would make sense to me, even though I don't necessarily agree with it. What is there, and you can do that. And once you sort of get in that habit, you, you can really, first of all, it's a skill. And second of all, like with respect to certainty, right? Like if I, like, so for example, like today, this morning in one of my classes, we were talking about, Donald Trump's presidency in 2016 and the 2016 election. And like, did they think that he was, you know, that his presidency was sort of cause or effect of a breakdown and whatever. We're talking about all this stuff. And so, I'm in a sociology. So obviously higher education tends to lean left. I'm in a sociology department, which leans left within higher education.
You guys are totally biased. Let's just put that.
Totally biased. Like, yeah, we're totally biased. The students are progressive, like by and large. I mean, I'm sure there are some exceptions, but you know, part of what I did is I said, okay, someone make, you know, this was an hour and 20 minute class, but one of the things that I challenged them with today is I said, make the argument that Donald Trump is not racist. I said, I don't care if you believe it. I was like, it makes no difference to me at all if you believe it. I said, make the strongest argument you can that Donald Trump isn't racist. And so then they have to think about it. And I'm like, okay, well, if that argument exists, there's a separate question to ask about how likely do you think it is that you know, any specific person holds that, is that their motive? But once you're not sure that somebody is motivated by hate, resentment, whatever, I don't know how you can, it's much harder to justify being contemptuous of that person. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that for any, and I use Donald Trump as an example, but you could do it for, you know, what is the version, if you're on the right, what is the version of somebody who thinks that we should have open borders? Mm-hmm. What is the version of that argument that I could understand? What is the version of the argument that why someone, thinks that kneeling during the national anthem is an important form of political expression? What is the version of that argument that I can understand? And so getting like, what is the version? I mean, and some of it's pretty counterintuitive, like in the sense of, you know, what is the version of, I don't think that we should be asking everyone their pronouns. What is the version of that argument, right? Like all of it. But I'm telling you that there is an argument for, and when there isn't, like when there is, when you hit, when you sort of hit something fun, like, so people will, like, the two examples that come up are really the Holocaust and slavery. People will say, are you both siding the Holocaust and slavery? And the answer is no, because what I'm saying is when you hit something for which there's no version of that argument that exists that makes sense to you, it's because you've bumped right up against some principle that's inviolable for you. Right. Like, so in the slavery case, I don't have to say what is the version, although some people make those arguments. I mean, I'm not prepared to, but right. Like I would say, because I think that all lives have equal moral value. Right. I'm done. Right. Like that's my principle. That's my value. I've hit bedrock. But I still think that I'm better off having been clear about what that principle is. Yeah. And why, and like, given that there is no version that makes sense to me, it's because that value is being, that principle is being violated. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. So more tactically, Ilana, so there's a neuroscience question here. It's not in your book, I believe, yeah. But so all of us are walking around with two brains, the left brain and right brain, they say, and I experienced it. My left brain is significantly different from my right brain. And most of the day, my left brain is in control. It wants data, it wants analysis, it wants precise prescriptions. And the right brain is just sitting there saying, well, there could be some uncertainty here and there, you know, do you really want to do it? And then later on, when the right brain becomes dominant, it makes decisions very differently. And we know this is, you know, from a biological perspective, this is true. And so going back to your ideas, I wondered, you know, what does that mean for people that they're actually walking around with two different brains?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So that's fascinating. I mean, let me answer and or give what I think is an answer. I think that there's a reason. No, let me back up. Not I think. There is a reason. There is a reason why the book is called The Certainty Trap. And that is, oh, I just had a cat jump up on the table. There is a distinction between between certainty and trap, right? There's a distinction to be made between those words, in the sense that I don't think of all certainty as being a trap that you need to avoid. And I think that the trap part is really, now, again, you could have a broader philosophical conversation, and I go into this a little bit in the book about the physical and abstract worlds and stuff. But the trap part is really that problem of contempt and what it does to our political discourse. So, you know, so when you talk about the left brain and right brain, I don't necessarily, I'm not saying that we all need to be wandering through our day going, you know, is this a phone? I'm not sure. Is this a pencil? I don't really know. I'm also not saying, but that's not because there's no uncertainty. That's just because it doesn't, I don't need to worry about it. Like, I'm good. Yes, there's some small probability that I'm living in the Matrix or some, you know, or like put some LSD.
No, very, very high probability, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, okay, sure, high probability. Whatever, I'm good with it. But what I'm talking about, what I would say is that it's really about these heated and contentious political issues because it has direct implications for democracy, for self-governance, for all of these other things that we care about. Now, it is true that once you start to think about uncertainty, like this comes up with students all the time, there is no place to draw the line. Like really, like there's you don't get to draw the line, and that's hard for people to. But again, like think about that number line, that spectrum of confidence, right? Like you can move along the space of confidence, but you don't get to draw the line. You don't get to draw the line. Let me stop there.
Yeah, I mean, your book is very important, Ilana. So, just skimming through it, I learned a lot from it. And so academics, or people who sort of deal with academics, they have this notion that we have a lot of information, you know, we can sort of walk through it to get to the right answer.
Yeah.
But most of the information is uncertain, is something that we don't really pay a lot of attention to, right? So in a decision tree, you know, I'm talking to the finance arena, the decision tree is very deterministic, very prescriptive. So you know, you assign some probability going on the left side or the right side, and then you get to some point. But none of those things really have that much value in terms of ultimate decisions. And so, I mean, this is really an interesting thing for the next generation. You know, so again, going back to education then, what are we teaching the kids? You know, is it that we figured everything out? Physics, chemistry, biology? I mean, most of those. I mean, I did some work in life sciences and physics, and I see most of the stuff we haven't figured out yet. So it's mostly uncertainty that we're dealing with, right?
I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, people have, I'm trying to remember the name. I'm not remembering the name of the guy who wrote the book, the End of Knowledge or the End of Science.
Knowledge, I would love it. Yeah, End of Knowledge.
I apologize if he ever listens. I feel terrible because he was a lovely man. But I think it is. I mean, this is why, you know, when there was a biologist and it was J.S. Haldane. Do you remember do you ever hear this quote who said, who asked about rats in the Precambrian?
Yeah.
Remember, yes. Right. So like he's, you know, someone asks him, what would unseat your faith in evolution, your belief in evolution? And his answer wasn't nothing. Right. Like his answer could have been nothing. But he didn't say nothing. He said rabbits in the Precambrian.
Rabbits in the Precambrian would completely destroy evolution.
That would destroy it. And so, you know, and so like there's always something that you could learn tomorrow that would upend what you know. There is uncertain. I mean, knowledge is just uncertain. I mean, it's interesting because one of the things that I think, if you think about, I think about kind of the world of morals and values as an abstract world versus the physical world. And a lot of times what we think about is we think of the physical world as approximating something like certainty. And we think of the world of morals and values as a little squishier, a little bit mushier around the edges. I think we have it backwards. I think that the world, the physical world is actually where there's always uncertainty. And I think in the world of morals and values, that is where you can come to something, you can define your way into something that looks a lot like, this is why, for example, 2 + 2 = 4. Like, I'm not saying that maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, right? Because mathematics exists, right? If you say in base 10 math and I say 2 + 2 = 4, like that's, in the world of mathematics, that is, we've completely defined the rules. Like, whereas if I say, if I ask the question, I've done this with students, like, if I hold my hand over a burning candle, am I going to burn my hand, right? And then in the hypothetical, in the thought experiment, the answer is yes, right? Like, I don't have nerve damage on my hand, right? Like, I'm going to burn my hand. In the real world, if I did that, the answer is maybe, probably, right? But could someone run in the room and blow out the candle and go, you moron, what are you doing? Like, why are you putting your hand on the candle? Like, right? Could the candle not light? Whatever. Like, it's just a different, that's kind of the difference. And I think that, yeah, so I think we get that backwards in a way that has implications that are pretty important.
Yeah. So we can talk about this forever, Elena. So do you have some closing thoughts? Let me just sort of think about this 1 minute. So clearly we have the social media, and I engage in social media as well. After reading your book, actually, I have changed some of my thought processes. Because I thought I knew how politics worked in the U.S. and what's going to happen in November. But as we say, most of that stuff is uncertain. And so to add value to society, you have to convince people of something. And that convincing takes not precise adjustments to what you believe, but really sort of a different language, different construct, right? So, you know, in some sense, social media is a problem in the sense that it's a bit like cocaine. You go in there and, you know, you just get a lot of highs by calling people names and all sorts of things. You're not thinking, mostly, I would say. So I got that education from your book. And if we can get to, you know, what I call a level one society, which is, you know, we are sort of understanding things more holistically, then we can go places. But the chances of that happening is, there's no zero probability events, but it's close to zero, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, people have to care about something. You have to care about something more than you care about being right. You have to. And you know, I'm not really in the business of trying to convince anybody of anything on a particular issue other than just, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. That's, I guess, if I'm trying to convince people of anything, it's that. I'm not really trying to teach people how to be more persuasive in an argument or how to win an argument. I'm just trying to sort of point out the assumptions that the uncertainty that's in the world and the value in making our assumptions and our principles and our goals, frankly, clear and explicit.
Yeah. I just want to touch on one more thing, Elena, before you go. So do you think academics have a bias? The reason I'm asking is that, you know, most of I'm not an academic, but I had, you know, sort of a lot of education. We've been, you know, sort of taught to think certain way, you know, data, hypothesis testing, reject, accept, null hypothesis, that type of stuff. So do you think that creates a bias that is really different from the general public? And so if this is true, then when, you know, Obama is a good example of this, actually, you go out and talk to people and you say, what the heck are you talking about? You know, we don't have time for this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, is what you're saying that like, so for example, like, so someone could look at the work that I'm doing and they could say, well, you know, this is a lot of navel gazing.
Yes.
And this, right, like this is, and like most people don't have time for this, don't have time or interest. And I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I think there are probably tiers of interest. I think there's, and I mean, if I could snap my fingers and change, you know, the way we run programming in schools and workplaces, right? Like there would be small, like there would be building blocks, there would be, right, so that they would sort of ladder up to something, but it wouldn't necessarily, I am not under the impression that everybody necessarily is interested in or has the time to sort of do the thinking work that I'm saying. I do think there are smaller pieces of it that you can bite off. I think that is also true. But again, like it's, if, why would you do this? The reason you would do it is because either you care about something more than you care about being right, or you want to understand as best you can what's true about the world. The one thing I want to say before you get off the call, before we end our call, is on my website, which is just my name, alanaredstone.com, there is, yeah, if anyone, there's no pre-orders for the book yet, but I do have a form on that site, which is if anyone wants to be notified when that's available, you can put your name and email down there.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks so much for spending time with me, Lana.
Thank you so much. Really, no, thank you.
Thank you.